Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Did you know you can get Democracy Now!'s headlines and stories delivered directly to your inbox every day? Just text Democracy Now!, one word, no space. Text Democracy Now! To 66866 to subscribe to our daily digest, and you'll never miss a story. Once again, Democracy Now!, one word, to 66866. Thanks so much, and stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Compared to the virus we had circulating initially in the United States at the start of the pandemic, the Delta variant is more aggressive and much more transmissible than previously circulating strains. It is one of the most infectious respiratory viruses we know of and that I have seen in my 20-year career.
COVID cases continue to rise in the United States and around the world, especially in areas with low vaccination rates. We'll speak to Yale epidemiologist Greg Gonsalves on the three things Biden can do right now to stop COVID and save lives. Then we look at the case of former Air Force analyst Daniel Hale, who blew the whistle on the secret U.S. drone and targeted assassination program.
Daniel Hale faces up to 11 years in prison. His sentencing is on Tuesday. Daniel Hale is a courageous whistleblower who exposed the extent of the U.S. drone strike program. He does not deserve to go to prison, and we are going to be fighting for his freedom and showing our solidarity with him from the grassroots.
Plus, we remember civil rights legend and educator Bob Moses. He's died at the age of 86. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As COVID-19 cases continue to rise around the world, fueled by the more transmissible Delta variant, more countries are enacting or considering health passes for vaccinated people. France just approved a highly contested law making proof of vaccination or a negative COVID test mandatory for accessing certain indoor venues. Germany says it's considering similar measures amid surging cases there. In Indonesia, hundreds of children have died in recent weeks as infections continue to surge and hospitals are pushed past their breaking point. Children may make up as many as 12.5% of Indonesia's confirmed infections. Other Southeast Asian countries, include Thailand and Malaysia, have recently reported record case numbers. Meanwhile, a recent study by The Lancet found over 1.5 million children lost a primary or secondary caregiver to COVID-19. In Tokyo, Japan, Olympic organizers reported 10 new cases related to the Games on Sunday. Here in the U.S., top medical advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci warned Sunday the U.S. is going in the wrong direction due to the large number of unvaccinated people who continue to get sick and fuel outbreaks. Only around half of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated. Fauci also said the Centers for Disease Control was considering new mask guidelines for vaccinated people amidst the current surge. St. Louis, Missouri is the latest place to reinstate its indoor mask mandate as cases in the state spike. Meanwhile, Alabama's Republican Governor Kay Ivey said it's, quote, time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks for COVID's persistent spread.
Almost 100% of the new hospitalizations are with unvaccinated folks, and the deaths are certainly occurring with unvaccinated folks. These folks are choosing a horrible lifestyle of self-inflicted pain. Y'all, we've got to get folks to take the shot.
In other coronavirus news, advocates are calling on the Biden administration to take action after it upheld a Trump memo, which would send some 4,000 prisoners currently in home confinement back to jail once the pandemic state of emergency is lifted. Biden would either have to commute their sentences or Congress could pass a law extending home confinement beyond the emergency order. The president of Tunisia dismissed the prime minister and suspended parliament Sunday, announcing he would take on executive power with the assistance of a new prime minister. The move came following major protests across Tunisia against the ruling and not the party. This is a protester speaking just hours before the president's announcement.
The main demand is that the Ennahda movement, which ruled for 10 years and did not provide us with solutions, leave the parliament. As a young man in 2011, I called for jobs, freedom, and national dignity. And in 2021, I still call for jobs, freedom, and national dignity.
Police released tear gas on crowds after they poured into the streets to celebrate the news, as some members of parliament and others accused the president of launching a state coup. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera is reporting police raided their Tunis office earlier today, expelling all the staff and confiscating equipment. The UN says a record 2,400 Afghan civilians were killed or wounded in May and June as fighting between government and Taliban forces escalates. The number of casualties reported in the first half of this year was nearly 50% higher than in 2020. The Afghan government just imposed a nationwide curfew in an effort to curb Taliban advances. Meanwhile, the top U.S. general in Afghanistan said it is likely to continue its airstrikes even after August 31st, when U.S. and NATO forces are expected to complete their withdrawal. The U.S. military launched its second drone strike in Somalia in under a week Friday. It was also the second attack targeting al-Shabaab fighters in Somalia since President Biden took office. Minnesota Congressmember Ilhan Omar, whose family came to the U.S. as Somali refugees, wrote a letter to Biden requesting more information about the strikes. She said, quote, "It's critical that any military action must be part of a broader strategy focused on the security of the Somali people and the stability of the Somali state," unquote. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot and killed a Palestinian teenager during a protest over illegal Israeli settlements near the town of Beitah. Mohammed Munir al-Tamimi was 17 years old. Over 300 others were injured as Israeli soldiers fired tear gas, rubber bullets and live ammunition on the crowds. Sierra Leone has abolished the death penalty. It's the 23rd African country to do so. Advocates there say capital punishment is a brutal remnant of colonial and that the recent vote could serve as an example for the United States. In Guatemala, protests calling for the resignation of the right-wing president Alejandro Giammattei have intensified after the attorney general fired the country's top anti-corruption prosecutor Friday. Juan Francisco Sandoval fled Guatemala just hours after being ousted, fearing for his life. Protesters are also condemning government corruption and the deadly mishandling of the pandemic. The Mexican government is sending two boatloads of food and medical supplies to Cuba, including oxygen tanks, needles and syringes. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has denounced catastrophic U.S. sanctions on Cuba that have triggered an economic crisis on the island and a massive shortage of resources during the pandemic, leading to the recent unrest. In India, at least 135 people are dead after torrential rains triggered massive floods and landslides across the state of Maharashtra and the city of Mumbai. Dozens are still missing as rescue efforts continue. While monsoon rains are common in India, climate scientists warn global warming has contributed to heavier and more devastating rainfall. This is a resident of Mumbai.
The level of the flood water never rose to 20 to 25 feet. The water level has risen to this height for the first time. All the properties of the residents are destroyed. They have nothing to eat and drink.
In more climate news, Northern California's Dixie Fire has become the state's largest blaze this year. After it exploded in size in recent days due to high winds and hot, dry temperatures, California fire officials said the blaze had merged with a smaller fly fire over the weekend as they continue to rage through Butte and Plumas counties, forcing residents to evacuate. Dozens of structures have been destroyed, with thousands more at risk. As of Sunday, both the Dixie and fly fires had burned a combined over 195,000 acres. Meanwhile, the Oregon's bootleg fire has destroyed more than 400,000 acres. Oregon Governor Kate Brown said the climate crisis, quote, is a hammer hitting us in the head.
We're going to see more of these wildfires. They're hotter, they're more fierce, and obviously much more challenging to tackle. And they are a sign of the changing climate impacts. In the last year, Oregon has had 4 federal emergency declarations. Climate change is here. It's real. And it's like a hammer hitting us in the head, and we have to take action.
That's Oregon Governor Kate Brown speaking on CNN. At least 86 active large wildfires in the U.S. have scorched nearly 1.5 million acres. This comes as another searing heat wave is set to hit much of the country this week, including the Pacific Northwest, the Rocky Mountains, and the Great Plains. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi added Illinois Congress member and Trump critic Adam Kinzinger to the special committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection. He's the second Republican after Liz Cheney to join the committee. Kinzinger and Cheney were 2 of just 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach Trump over his role in instigating the deadly riot. He was censured by his party for publicly opposing Trump. A growing number of Republican lawmakers are calling on Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy to punish Cheney and Kinzinger for joining the committee. The House panel will start hearing testimony this week. After Nancy Pelosi said no to 2 of McCarthy's 5 Republican picks, he pulled all 5. Mississippi's attorney general urged the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade, asking it to rule in favor of a highly contested Mississippi law that would ban most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The majority conservative Supreme Court agreed to hear the case in May. It's expected to be argued later this year. The president of the Center for Reproductive Rights, Nancy Northup, said the move from Mississippi, quote, reveals the extreme and regressive strategy, not just of this law, but of the avalanche of abortion bans and restrictions that are being passed across the country, she said. In New York, over 1,000 immigrants, activists, and their supporters took to the streets Friday to demand Congress and President Biden include in the infrastructure package a pathway to citizenship for all DACA recipients, TPS holders, and immigrant essential workers. Ushered by drivers from the New York Taxi Workers Union, demonstrators shut down traffic on the Manhattan Bridge. And civil rights leader Bob Moses has died at the age of 86. Bob Moses worked with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to register voters across Mississippi. A former high school teacher, he went on to found the Algebra Project, devoted to improving access to education, particularly in math, for students of color. In 2009, Democracy Now! Spoke with Bob Moses on the first day of the Obama presidency about the ongoing challenges in education.
In our country, I think we run sharecropper education. So if we carry that forward into the information age, then we will have serfs in our cities, just like we had serfs in the Delta, Mississippi in the industrial era. And this is the huge challenge facing our country. I think what we need is a movement for our constitutional rights. We need a constitutional amendment, something which simply says every child in the country is a child of the country and is entitled to a quality public school education.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at how 6 months into the Biden administration, COVID-19 cases are continuing to soar here in the United States and around the world. As the highly contagious Delta variant drives an increase in infections, especially in areas with low vaccination rates, some U.S. cities like St. Louis, Missouri, and Los Angeles have reinstated mask mandates indoors and on public transportation for everyone, even vaccinated people. On Sunday, the country's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, told CNN the United States is in, quote, unnecessary predicament.
We're going in the wrong direction. If you look at the inflection of the curve of new cases, and as you said in the run-in to this interview, that it is among the unvaccinated. And since we have 50% of the country is not fully vaccinated, that's a problem, particularly when you have a variant like Delta, which has this extraordinary characteristic of being able to spread very efficiently and very easily from person to person.
Meanwhile, a new campaign kicked off Friday that aims to use the Olympic Games to raise awareness that much of the world has yet to see a single vaccine dose, with less than 1% of COVID vaccines now distributed to low-income countries, 0.3%. The People's Vaccine Alliance and Public Citizen are pushing rich countries to, quote, stop playing games and invest in global vaccine manufacturing. This video features people from India, vaccination rate 24%, Zimbabwe 8%, Colombia 30%, Philippines 9%, Liberia vaccination rate just 2%.
The Olympics slogan appears to be faster, higher, stronger, together. If we're going to go faster, higher, stronger, together, we have to be alive.
When I heard that there was a vaccine, I was so hopeful. And I thought, wow, this is going to change things for us. Now people are dying around me.
We were watching the news that the U.S. were vaccinating people at this tremendously fast rate, and we were not having like one single vaccine applied here.
I'm still waiting to get vaccinated. If you ask me when, I still don't know.
How can we now play Olympics when there is COVID still raging like hell in Africa?
The campaign calls on President Biden to launch a $25 billion global vaccine manufacturing program to produce 8 billion doses of mRNA vaccine within a year, enough for more than half the world's population. On Friday, dozens of members of Congress called for including additional funding in the reconciliation package to produce and distribute COVID-19 vaccines worldwide, saying, quote, no investment in the fight against COVID-19 is more urgent and cost-effective now than an investment in getting the world vaccinated as quickly as possible. For more, we're joined by Greg Gonsalves, co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership and assistant professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. His article for The Nation is headlined, Three Things Biden Can Do Right Now to Stop COVID and Save Lives. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Gonsalves. So why don't you just lay those out? Start with what you think is the most important thing 6 months into his presidency, President Biden can do?
So a couple of three things. First is that we need massive scale up of mRNA vaccines, as the new campaign suggests. We can do that in a couple of different ways, and we need to do them both at the same time. One is to invest in vaccine hubs around the world, like the one in South Africa that the World Health Organization announced a few weeks ago. That's going to require an investment, not just of money, but of time, people, effort, technology transfer for the recipes and all the other sort of technical know-how that's involved in manufacturing these mRNA vaccines. But we can also produce at home under the Defense Production Act and set up a factory here or nearby in Canada, for instance, or in our partner nations in the EU to scale up closer to home where companies like Moderna have partners like Lonza, which is in New Hampshire, which could be supported through the Defense Production Act by $10 billion that's already sitting in the Treasury from the American Rescue Plan Act for instances just like this to scale up mRNA vaccines. There's been sort of a line from the company executives that we're working as fast as we can and you'll have all you need in a year or so. In a year or so with Delta means there's going to be millions more infected, millions more dead around the world. Finally, you know, as you said, our vaccination in the United States is not as great as we would like it to be. That means there's millions of unused doses sitting around the United States, some getting ready to expire. But we should be exporting vaccines rather than sitting on them and hoarding them. You know, we've talked about, we just saw last week that the U.S. has suggested we're going to purchase 200 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine for potential boosting of our own population, when, as you said in earlier in this segment, that there's some countries that have 2% of their population vaccinated. If we don't stop the virus all around the world, we're not going to stop it anywhere, as we've seen with the emergence of Delta and Alpha and other variants from one nation quickly spreading across the globe and taking over.
So Dr. Walensky, for example, the head of the CDC, has called the pandemic in the United States now the pandemic of the unvaccinated. Well over, close to 100% of the people who are dying or hospitalized are unvaccinated. Isn't the world that writ large? I mean, we see the crisis in the United States for what this means. So if you could comment on your last point. I'm looking at an article in Stat. Millions of unused COVID-19 vaccines are set to go to waste as demand dwindles in the United States. Doses likely to expire this summer. Several state health departments told Stat they've repeatedly asked the federal government to redistribute their supply to other countries, many of which are facing a third wave of COVID-19 pandemic. Officials in Washington have rejected those requests, citing legal and logistical challenges. They quote the Arkansas Air National Guard, who's leading the state's COVID-19 vaccine distribution drive. They're a retired colonel saying, "We are drowning in this stuff." This is incredible.
It's incredible. Also, two colleagues of mine here at Yale, Saad Omer and Mushfiq Mubarak, have done a study to suggest that there's great demand for the vaccine, just not in the United States. Low and middle income countries are desperate for the vaccines. And the best way to get more people vaccinated is to do what you're suggesting, is to get it out of the U.S. and put it in countries that are desperate to get more people vaccinated. The Biden administration has been full of excuses, right? It can't do this, it can't do that. It gratefully, showed its support for the TRIPS waiver a few months ago, but that was the end of it, right? Promises of this, promises of that. We have a one-time chance, right? We don't get to do this over again in 2 years when the virus is spread around the world and there are millions and millions more people infected. We're on a tight timeline. We need to stop this now. The U.S. can do this, as Public Citizens Campaign suggests, $25 billion for 8 billion doses, or even less than that in some of the other sort of analyses I've seen, for instance, for PrEP for All. We could do this in a cost-effective manner and vaccinate the world. I'm an AIDS activist. I remember when President Bush announced the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and everybody said it was impossible to get antiretroviral therapy to low- and middle-income countries. Well, it got done, and now there are millions of people around the world alive today because of that work. President Biden could be a leader, and this could be his legacy. Right now, the legacy is not looking good. He's the person who let the pandemic rage across the world when he could have done something.
On Friday, Pfizer said the United States government will purchase 200 million more doses of its coronavirus vaccine. This is White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki responding to the announcement.
Many times that we were like Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, and we were going to prepare for every contingency. That's the job of the federal government, right, to ensure we have maximum flexibility. We don't know if we'll need a booster shot. That's going to be up to the research that's ongoing with the FDA. That's not a recommendation that's currently made. We also don't know. We also can't predict what the outcome will be of research on kids under 12. We're certainly hopeful. And we don't know which vaccine will be most effective, but we want to have maximum flexibility. So this is an effort to provide us with that.
So if you could comment on this and also the whole debate over boosters. I said Pfizer announced the U.S. government would be buying this. Also, Pfizer announced that probably you would need boosters, despite a rare joint CDC FDA statement saying that, in fact, is not the case. Who's running the show here, the pharmaceutical companies in the United States or the Biden administration?
If we talk about the history of drug pricing and drug regulation in the United States, we know who runs the show here in the United States, the pharmaceutical lobby. That's part of the point. The point is that the Biden administration is taking its line from industry on this. We may need boosters for the immunocompromised, for the elderly. We've seen some breakthrough infections with Delta, which are concerning. The point is that at this point, suggestions like the press secretary is making about potentially needing boosters or potentially needing to vaccinate kids this fall or into the winter amounts to hoarding right now, right? And it's, everybody complained about President Trump's sort of America First policy. Well, this is a little bit about America First 2.0. The point is that there are millions and billions of people around the world that are dire risk for sickness and death from COVID-19. There are new variants being spawned every day. We let the virus mutate and replicate across the world. And so this whole idea that we're going to sort of keep you know, stockpiling vaccines here until we can vaccinate ourselves 10 times over, like some other countries like Canada, it's just unseemly, unnecessary, and unwise.
So explain how it would work and also explain what COVAX is. But for Africa, for Asia, what it would look like if, well, for example, the TRIPS waiver were granted on intellectual property, forcing the companies. It's interesting, the main countries who are saying no to a waiver are Germany and England, where two of the major pharmaceutical companies are based that made the vaccines. What would it look like if it was made available, the recipes, to other pharmaceutical companies who haven't developed the vaccine but have the ability to manufacture it?
Well, you know, look, the TRIPS waiver is being negotiated now. It's going to take some time. The United States put in lots of money, billions of dollars, into the development of the Moderna vaccine. We also own large chunks of the intellectual property and patents on those vaccines. So we don't need the TRIPS waiver to do a domestic production effort to scale up, you know, millions and billions of doses in the United States. We can do it tomorrow. Right. We could say we're going to make an effort to build a vaccine, a new plant, a retrofit a plant in the United States or somewhere nearby. We could invoke our intellectual property and patent rights as the American public on those vaccines. Use the money that's in the bank, the $10 billion in the Treasury, to scale up vaccination right now. At the same time, you know, South Africa is setting up a hub to manufacture COVID vaccines and probably pandemic vaccines for the long term. There are other companies around the world who could get on board to manufacture mRNA vaccines with appropriate technology transfer. It just the main thing that's absent at the current moment is political will from the White House. And I don't know who is advising the president on that. That ignoring the global pandemic is a wise policy move in any way, shape, or form. He may think his domestic concerns are a priority, but that is so short-sighted and myopic, that's putting us in danger, right? Again, we're not going to vanquish this virus. We're not going to bring it down to levels that will give us some semblance of normality within the next 2 to 3 years unless we can deal with the global pandemic. And we need the political will to do it. The mechanics of it, you know, we have a federal government that can figure out many different ways of getting this done. They have the tools, they have the resources, they have the power, they have the claims on the mRNA vaccine from Moderna right now, without any sort of any extraordinary measures to do what's right now.
Explain these breakthrough infections and how concerned you think people should be in the United States, around the world. In L.A., 20% of the new infections are people who've been fully vaccinated.
Well, let's put it this way. You know, these vaccines are enormously potent at preventing serious disease and death, right? You know, so if you catch SARS-CoV-2, having been vaccinated with the mRNA vaccines, you're likely to have an asymptomatic or mild infection. The point is that it's all about exposure, right? You know, these vaccines are not 100% effective. And if you put 10 people in a room who are unvaccinated, shedding the Delta variant, which is highly contagious, as Dr. Fauci mentioned, you're just putting the vaccines at a distinct disadvantage. The vaccine-acquired immunity that you've got is not a brick wall. They're 95% effective, 91% effective. I can't remember the exact figures, but that doesn't mean 100%. And so you need to be able to protect yourself from being basically awash in a sea of virus where vaccines can stumble. That being said, the number of vaccinated people who are in hospitals right now is a tiny, tiny proportion of the people hospitalized. 99% of people who are in hospitals right now are unvaccinated individuals in the United States.
We just have 30 seconds, Greg, but as you said, you are a longtime AIDS activist. We're talking to you as an epidemiologist at Yale University, but can you talk about the role of activism, for example, for what you think needs to be done for Biden at this point to ensure that people around the world are vaccinated, which would protect, of course, his own country, the United States?
So AIDS activists are back in the game for COVID-19. And many of us who were arguing for access to COVID-19 vaccines and mRNA scale-up are the same people who were fighting for global AIDS treatment access 20 years ago. The point is, this is a political problem right now. It's not a technological one. It's not a legal one. It is a political problem. And AIDS activists, people who care about the health of the planet, who care about the health of Americans, need to get to the White House, to get to the officials in Congress, who can get to the White House and say, get to work. The point is, we can beat COVID globally if we have the political will to do so.
Greg Gonzalez, we want to thank you for being with us, co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership, assistant professor at epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health. We'll link to your piece in The Nation, three things Biden can do right now to stop COVID and save lives. Next up, we look at the case of former Air Force analyst Daniel Hale, who blew the whistle on the secret U.S. drone and target assassination program. He faces up to 11 years in prison, will be sentenced Tuesday. Stay with us. By Ali Fakhr Toure and Tumani Jabate. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration's urging a federal court to sentence drone whistleblower Daniel Hale to at least 9 years in prison for leaking classified information about the U.S. drone and target assassination program. Hale was enlisted in the U.S. Air Force from 2009 to 2013, during which time he worked with the National Security Agency and JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Task Force, at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, where he helped identify targets for assassination. He later worked as a contractor for the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. In March, Daniel Hale pleaded guilty to one count of violating the World War I era Espionage Act for leaking documents exposing the drone program. He'll be sentenced Tuesday. In a handwritten letter to Judge Liam O'Grady, Hale describes feeling immense guilt for his role in the U.S. assassination program. He wrote, quote, "Not a day goes by that I don't question the justification for my actions." Hale went on to write, "To say that the period of my life spent serving in the United States Air Force had an impression on me would be an understatement. It's more accurate to say that it irreversibly transform my identity as an American." Daniel Hale's lawyers are seeking a 12 to 18 month sentence. In a court filing, his lawyers state, quote, "The facts regarding Mr. Hale's motive are clear. He committed the offense to bring attention to what he believed to be immoral government conduct committed under the cloak of secrecy and contrary to public statements of then President Obama regarding the alleged precision of the United States military's drone program." Famed NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden has voiced his support for Daniel Hale. I spoke to Ed Snowden in May.
Daniel Hale is one of the most consequential whistleblowers who sacrificed everything, an incredibly courageous person, to tell us that the drone war that, you know, is so obviously occurring to everyone else, but the government was still officially denying in so many ways, is here. It is happening. And 90% of the casualties in 1 5-month period were innocents or bystanders or not the target of the drone strike. We could not establish that. We could not prove that without Daniel Hale's voice.
In a moment, we'll be joined by one of Daniel Hale's close friends, as well as one of his lawyers. But first, we turn to Daniel Hale, in his own words, speaking in the documentary National Bird, a film by Sonia Kennebec.
The people who defend drones and defend the way that they're used, they always say, you know, they protect American lives by not putting them in harm's way. But what they really do is they just embolden commanders. They embolden decision makers because there is no threat. There is no immediate consequence. they can do this strike and they can potentially kill this person that they're so desperate to get and to eliminate because of how dangerous, potentially dangerous, they could be to the U.S. But if it just so happens that they don't kill that person or that some other people are involved in the strike and get killed as well, you know, there's no consequence for it. When it comes to high-value targeting, every mission is to go after one person at a time. But anybody else that's killed in that strike is just blanketly assumed to be an associate of the targeted individual. So as long as they can reasonably identify that all of the people in the field of view of the camera are military-aged males, meaning anybody who's believed to be of age 16 or older, they are a legitimate target under the rules of engagement. If the strike occurs and kills all of them, they just say that they got them all.
That's Daniel Hale speaking in the documentary National Bird, a film by Sonia Kennebec. We're joined now in Washington, D.C. by two guests. Jocelyn Radak is an attorney for Daniel Hale, directs the Whistleblower and Source Protection Program at Expose Facts. And Noor Mir is with us. She's a close friend of Daniel Hale. She's part of the Daniel Hale support team. She first met Hale in 2013 when doing anti-drone advocacy with Code Pink. Jocelyn Radak, let's begin with you. Tuesday is the day of sentencing. Talk about what Daniel Hale is has confessed to and what the defense, what you're asking for and what you expect him to receive.
Daniel has pled guilty to one count under the Espionage Act for an unauthorized disclosure to the media. So he is facing a sentence range that's between 1 to 10 years for that infraction. However, part of his guilty plea, unlike the usual situation where you plead guilty for a certain amount of time that is definite, here the time has not been determined. So at sentencing, a lot of different groups, Daniel himself, his supporters, people in civil liberties community and target groups of drone strikes and whistleblower groups, media groups are all arguing that he should be shown mercy because he was tried under a very draconian law to which he could not raise a defense.
So can you give us the chronology of what took place? I mean, The Intercept published the drone papers in 2015. Daniel Hale released this information, the documents that he got, to a journalist. Explain Daniel's rationale further than this extremely significant handwritten note he gave to the judge last week.
Daniel's rationale was that not only was information about drone strikes being denied, but it was also being lied about by people in power. The U.S. was consistently understating the amount of innocent civilians who were targeted and using overbroad targeting lists. So Daniel ended up going to the press, but his case has spanned a long time period. His house was searched in 2014, but he wasn't indicted until 2019. And here we are in 2021 for his sentencing. So this has been an odyssey that has occupied most of the better part of his adult life for basically committing the truth. The U.S. has never contested any of Daniel's disclosures. And when asked to do a statement about what kind of harm Daniel caused, it did not do a damage assessment and did not submit any kind of statement about harm because there wasn't any.
Noor Mir, you're a close friend of Daniel Hale. Talk about how you met him, what's happening, and then your understanding of what took place over the years.
Absolutely. So I met Daniel Hale in 2013. He was beginning his journey in anti-war activism, and I was running a campaign with Code Pink around lethal drone warfare. And it was hard at the time to get people to even believe the stories of survivors from places like Yemen and Pakistan and Somalia. And here we had a veteran who was who not only believed these stories, but was able to talk about what he had witnessed. Over the years, before Daniel moved to Tennessee, he was a vocal supporter of opposing wars around the world. And when he came back to D.C. To prepare for his sentencing and his trial, Daniel remained committed to opposing injustices. He, while working at different restaurants in D.C., also took to the streets last summer for Black Lives Matter. And the last time that I saw him was actually at the White House, where we showed up to support young Yemeni people that were hunger striking to urge the Biden administration to stop supporting the Saudi blockade on Yemen. So that is Daniel's character, and I know that when he's out, he will remain committed to ending suffering in all forms.
I want to go back to when you met him. In November 2013, Daniel Hale spoke at a drone summit in Washington, D.C., organized by your group, Code Pink. This is Daniel in his own words.
Before I begin, one last thing. I just would like to, in a way, say I'm sorry. I'm not up here for any good reasons. And to the people in the audience who are victims or who are families of victims or have families who live in countries where U.S. militarism and specifically unmanned systems are conducting kinetic strikes. I'm sorry because I'm up here because I was for a time, a short period of time during my military career, as an analyst working with unmanned systems deployed to Afghanistan. And at the very least, you all deserve an apology.
So that's Daniel in 2013 when you met him. I want to go just a little further to January 2014 when he spoke at a rally outside the White House, as you described, calling for the closing of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Daniel Hale. I was a veteran in the United States Air Force from 2009 until 2013. Through my experience and my deployment to Afghanistan, where I was primarily tasked with pursuing high-value targets through the utilization of unmanned systems, or otherwise known as drones, I came to learn of the thousands of prisoners who remain at the prison in Bagram Air Force Base to this day who are in similar situations to those at Guantanamo, who are continually held indefinitely for benign or otherwise petty offenses or reasons not given to them whatsoever.
So that was Daniel Hale about 6 years ago. Noor-Mir, if you can talk about what haunts Daniel the most about the assassination targeting he was doing in Afghanistan, and you yourself, your family is from Pakistan, you've interviewed drone attack survivors. If you can talk about the impact on Daniel.
Yeah, thank you for that question. And I would say the impact of everything that is happening and has happened in Daniel's life, where I see it showing up the most is he is hungry for people to care about the actual story of those people that were not intended targets. He wants people, when they are outraged about what's happening to him as a whistleblower, to care equally about truth tellers that have traveled to the U.S. to demand justice for people like Nabila, who was playing in a field as a 7-year-old in Pakistan and saw her grandmother blown into pieces, about Abdul Rahman, who was a teenager who was eating dinner with his cousins 2 weeks after his father was assassinated and similarly was killed, about Faisal, who Daniel wrote about in his letter and was a speaker at the drone conference that that I organized, who was actually denied an apology by Obama's Department of Justice in exchange for offering to drop his lawsuit against them. I think that's what haunts Daniel, is that those stories are not being centered. And that is the motive that he has explained for what for his disclosures.
Noor, New York Magazine did a very powerful piece about Daniel called The Drone Leaker. And in it, they describe this intervention that you did, organizing all of his friends. He didn't know this was going to happen, to be with him, to more defend himself than he was. Can you talk about that?
Yes, and I think a lot of this stems from his discomfort at being the center of the story. He said, this isn't about me. Why is this about me? This is about the people that were killed that are still being killed. And that discomfort, I think, ended up being paralyzing. He felt like he shouldn't be the one that people are writing about, that he shouldn't be, you know, taking away resources or attention. And we needed to have this intervention to say, hey, actually, what is happening to you will impact how future whistleblowers and truth tellers approach this. It might hold them back. It's important for you to be able to talk about what's going on, and we are here to support you. So that intervention was needed. I'm sure it was uncomfortable, but we're very grateful for all the friends that have come together to be able to support Daniel in this way.
And can you explain, knowing him as you do, when asked how he should be described, you know, as a whistleblower, he said, no, as a traitor. What does he mean?
That's a really good question. I think that for Daniel, you know, that is what the government is calling him. And I think that I see it as an attempt to say, you can call me that. You can call me a traitor if that is how you want to paint me. So I believe that, you know, this is his way of saying, you can call me what you want, but I did what I did. And I know that I did it for the right reasons.
Before we end, I want to read more from Daniel Hale's letter to the judge and get Jesselyn Radack's final words. Daniel Hale wrote in, you know, his own handwriting, Your Honor, the truest truism that I've come to understand about the nature of war is that war is trauma. I believe that any person either called upon or coerced to participate in war against their fellow man is promised to be exposed to some form of trauma. In that way, no soldier blessed to have returned home from war does so uninjured. The crux of PTSD is that it's a moral conundrum that afflicts invisible wounds on the psyche of a person made to burden the weight of experience after surviving a traumatic event. How PTSD manifests depends on the circumstances of the event. So how is the drone operator to process this? The victorious rifleman, unquestioningly remorseful, at least keeps his honor intact by having faced off against his enemy on the battlefield. The determined fighter pilot has the luxury of not having to witness the gruesome aftermath. But what possibly could I have done to cope with the undeniable cruelties that I perpetuated? My conscience, once held at bay, came roaring back to life. At first, I tried to ignore it, wishing instead that someone, better placed than I, should come along to take this cup from me. But this, too, was folly. Left to decide whether to act, I only could do that which I ought to do before God and my own conscience. The answer came to me that to stop the cycle of violence, I ought to sacrifice my own life and not that of another person. So I contacted an investigative reporter with whom I had had an established prior relationship and told him I had something the American people needed to know. Those are the words of Daniel Hale in a handwritten letter to the judge last week. Jesselyn Radack, you have 30 seconds. This is just 24 hours before the judge will rule on Daniel's sentencing.
unfortunately, what you just read in that moving letter is not allowed in had this case gone to trial. Dan has expressed sentiments similar to other drone clients, but under the Espionage Act, your intent, your pure motive is irrelevant. And that is the cruelty that the government tried him under such a strenuous, draconian law that he can't raise any of what you just read as a defense to why he blew the whistle.
Jessalyn Radak, I want to thank you for being with us. One of the attorneys for Daniel Hale, director of the Whistleblower and Source Protection Program at Exposed Facts, and Noor Mir, close friend of Daniel Hale, part of his support team. Next up, Bob Moses remembered in his own words. Stay with us. I Believe by Sweet Honey in the Rock. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Civil rights leader Bob Moses has died at the age of 86. He worked with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, to register voters across Mississippi. In 1964, he helped organize the Mississippi Freedom Summer Project. Bob Moses went on to found the Algebra Project, devoted to improving access to education, particularly in math, for students of color. In 2009, I spoke with Bob Moses on the first day of the Obama presidency. He talked about how civil rights activists in the 60s helped lay the foundation for Obama's presidency.
In order to become president of the United States, you have to be nominated by one of the two political parties. So the crucial thing for me was, in reflecting back, was the 1964 challenge of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party to the National Democratic Convention, because that was where the stage was set that allowed this to happen. Because without opening up the national political structure in the country, this wasn't going to happen. And, you know, we could have gotten the right to vote without the opening up of the national political party structure. And the party structure wasn't opened up by getting the right to vote. The party structure was opened up by directly challenging in Mississippi the right of Mississippi to send an all-white delegation to the 1964 National Democrat Convention. And it was Fannie Lou Hamer and all the people in that delegation that really forced the National Democratic Party to open up, you know. And it was that. I mean, Barack Obama could not be running for president if he had not been able to secure a party to run for. And the Democratic Party, from the time of after the Civil War right until 1964, there were no black delegates to the Democratic Party from the South. And it was that action, more than anything else, which opened up the national party structure and allowed eventually what is happening today to happen.
Can you take us from 1964, the battle for voting and civil rights, to what you see happening today, to the progress and also warnings that you have for us, or suggestions, recommendations?
So my main idea, I try to look at this event in through the lens of the evolution in this country, of the idea of who in our country are the people who have constitutional rights and constitutional responsibilities, and the evolution of the expansion of that. And I think the country kind of moves in cycles trials, which take roughly around three quarters of a century. So I look at the time from 1787 until the Civil War as a time in which we had, yes, constitutional people, mostly white men, but then we had constitutional property, African Americans who were slaves. And then we had this horrendous war. 600,000 people are killed during the war. And we come out of the war, and Lincoln, whom Obama is rightly looking at, we get rid of the idea of constitutional property, but African Americans don't quite become full-fledged citizens. And when we were in Mississippi, people all the time were saying, well, we want to be first-class citizens. And so the implication being that they were second or even third-class citizens. So the civil rights movement, and here I have to, I think we have to give credibility to the sit-in movement, to the young black students at the historically black colleges who really dismantled Jim Crow in the area of its public accommodations with the sit-in movement. They actually dismantled that aspect of Jim Crow. So then there was this dismantling of it around the right to vote and what I was talking about earlier, also around the national party structure. But, you know, when I was sitting in the federal district courthouse, I was in the witness stand. And if you remember, this was in the spring of 1963. And at that time, President Kennedy was still alive. Bobby Kennedy was Attorney General. Burke Marshall was the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. And John Doe was my lawyer. He was their chief litigator in the field. And the judge, Judge Clayton, who was a federal district judge, we had taken hundreds of sharecroppers in Greenwood to register, and then subsequently the SNCC field secretaries had been arrested. And Burke had our cases removed to the federal courts. So Judge Clayton looks over and he wants to know, why are we taking illiterates down to register to vote? And so, in a nutshell, our answer is, well, the country can't have its cake and eat it, too. It can't have denied a whole people access to literacy through its political arrangements, and then turn around and say, well, you can't access politics because you're illiterate. And we won that struggle. We won it in the courts, and it was Judge Wisdom's decision in the case of U.S. v. Louisiana, where he said, well, we can't allow the state of Louisiana to have authority over the actual qualifications of voting, that has to be moved to the federal system. So the 1965 Voting Rights Act gave the federal government the responsibility of saying who could qualify for the right to vote. So, but we didn't win the issue of illiteracy, and I think that's the issue that in this evolution of who are the constitutional people, the children of our country do not have a constitutional right to a public school education. And you have to look at the Rodriguez case, 1971, Mexican Americans who sued in Texas for equity. Their case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, you can't come here into the federal system for relief because there's no substantive federal right to a constitutional right to an public school education in this country. I think really that in our country, and this is going to be a huge challenge for the Barack Obama administration, in our country, I think we run sharecropper education. That is an education that you can trace. When the judge asked me that question, because in the Delta of Mississippi, sharecroppers were assigned to do a certain kind of work, and so the idea was you only need a certain kind of education. So if we carry that forward into the information age, then we will have serfs in our cities, just like we had serfs in the Delta, Mississippi, in the industrial era. And this is the huge challenge facing our country. I think what we need is a movement for our constitutional rights. We need a constitutional amendment, something which simply says every child in the country is a child of the country and is entitled to a quality public school education.
That's civil rights leader Bob Moses, former field secretary for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and founder of the Algebra Project. He's died in Florida at the age of 86. To see our interview with him on Obama's first inauguration, along with Alice Walker, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.